Welcome to session 164. Long-haired preachers come out every night. Mormonism's role in the Joe Hill community.
From Crawford, Texas, up to Washington. She clearly is using the Joe Hill story and manipulating it for her political things. Now, this next song, I was watching one of the news channels during the Wisconsin labor disputes in the Wisconsin Capitol, and I heard a version of the Joe Hill song, Power in the Union. I wondered what Joe Hill and IWW Labor would have thought of a bunch of well-fed, white-collar government workers singing his song. But I think that he probably would have understood the situation when he explained to him and probably would have written another brilliant song.
And the power.
Perhaps his most favorite, famous. It's where he coins the term pie in the sky and introduces it to the English language. I think it's pretty relevant to the current debates over the budget and the deficit. And I think it's probably relevant to those of us who take seriously the Sermon on the Mount and King Benjamin's sermon in the Book of Mormon with the teachings on the poor. This song was probably written in response to a free speech strike in Spokane, Washington, but it pretty well expresses Joe Hill's attitude towards the organized religion of the day.
Joe Hill's union organizer in the USA is murdered by the forces of reaction, the enemies of James Baird. This song deals with the need of all free people then and now for a better life, now and long after that.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Talk about Joe Hill. There's a lot of speculation that's gone on in the past and goes on in the present about the facts of the crime and how the trial was conducted. And it seems to me that Oliver Wendell Holmes put it appropriately. It seems to me that at this time we need education in the obvious more than an investigation of the obscure. And today, the one thing I want to say, I just put this in that. If you've ever dealt in the law courts, you know there's no absolute truth. Lawyers know that there's a rate of error, and we know that there is no absolute thing that can come out. And in this particular case, there's some reasons why we have significant doubt as to what the actual facts from on high would have been. And the most important thing I would say is Joe Hill's last lawyer, Judge Orton Hilton, never told anyone. And if there's anyone that Joe Hill trusted at the end of this, it was Judge Hilton. Now, we're going to talk today about three things where Mormonism crossed the Joe Hill trial. If you ask the court system and the judges and the justices at the time, what did Mormonism have to do with the Joe Hill trial, they told you nothing. And in fact, the district attorney, the trial judge, the attorney general, and all the justices of the Supreme Court were non-Mormon. There had never been a Mormon on the court for the first 30 years of statehood. There had been one Mormon, Senator King, on the court, but briefly on the territorial days. And the court system was a distinct non-Mormon operation. In fact, if you look at the book that they put out in 1913, Bar and Bench of Utah, Mormons are virtually never found on the trial bench, and a very small percentage of the active lawyers are, in fact, LDS. Still, the perception's there, and the perception's what we deal with. So we're going to talk about how Mormonism was treated in the Utah Supreme Court. In spite of the fact that there were no Mormons on the court, it was treated surprisingly well. The second thing we're going to talk about is how did Heber C. Kimball's son get to be the Joe Hill jury foreman? There's a lot of misinformation about how Joseph Kimball came to be on the Joe Hill jury. And I think I can show pretty persuasively that neither the Mormons nor the copper bosses nor anyone else besides the defense lawyers had anything to do with putting him there. And the final thing is a real interesting story in Utah history about how Judge Hilton, after Joe Hill's death, performed the most remarkable anti-Mormon rant that I've ever come across, and how the Utah courts were very upset with him and, in fact, disbarred him. So let's talk first about how the Mormons were treated in the court. The first thing we have to talk about is the attitudes of the populace towards Mormons. And in fact, Mormons were viewed as being very favorable to corporations. This is Senator Frank J. Cannon, in fact, the first senator from the state of Utah. And in 1911, he wrote a book, Under the Prophet in Utah. And Cannon's a really a controversial figure. He's elected as a Republican. He immediately goes over to the Democrats on the Free Silver platform. He always was a political renegade. Well, he doesn't get reelected after his first term. He becomes editor of the Salt Lake Tribune and later the Ogden Standard. Both of these papers are editorially opposed to the church, and particularly the then church president, Joseph F. Smith. And Cannon's editorial opposition turns into vitriol. And traditionally, the Mormons look at Frank Cannon as an ingrate apostate. However, he's a much more complicated character than that. In his book, one of the main arguments that he makes is that in the heroic settlement period, the Mormon settlers worked together in their irrigation projects, and they're building the community resources. And it was an open, transparent system. For example, they would pay their tithing in kind to the local bishop, you know, whatever the community produced, whether it was grain or animals. And the bishop, the local bishop, could use that however he saw fit. And Cannon saw that as being a transparent system where the people could see the benefit of their sacrifice. But however, with the introduction of a cash economy, tithing was paid in dollars and cents, and it was paid to the church and was controlled by President Smith. And there's some basis for that. I mean, the Council on the Disposition of Tithes has never been totally transparent. But canon says that the people paid a tribute of $2 million in tithes, and he uses that income however he wants. And what's more, he's tied to the trust. Now, remember, this is the Progressive Era, and the big bugaboo are the National Trust. He rules the non-Mormon people of Utah as he rules his own people by virtue of his political and financial partnership with his great business interests that govern and exploit the nation and his kingdom for their gain and his. In other words, Mormons are the same as the great industrial corporations. And Cannon's not the only one that does this. If you read Leonard Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom, you find that during the Reed Smoot hearing, there was a whole magazine campaign that was trying to link the church to the trust. According to British newspapers, the church was believed to draw 100% dividend from the rubber trust, to have an interest in the National City Bank, to have controlling interest in the wool, beef, tin, oil, tobacco, iron, and farming implement industries. And of course, these connections to the national interests are pretty much fanciful. Poor agrarian people in the Great Basin has very little in common with Carnegie and Rockefeller. But the perception was there, and it spills over into the law courts. I want to tell you about a 1908 case. Now, the Supreme Court in 1908 is the same as the court in 1915 that heard the Joe Hill case. So we're talking about the same three justices. Mrs. Paul, who used to be Paul, stepped off a railroad car in Salt Lake City and hurt herself. And she sued the Salt Lake Railroad Company, streetcar company. The company was owned by the church, and the president was church president Joseph F. Smith. And the cause of action was for negligence. Now, Utah at that time, like every other jurisdiction, followed this really strict doctrine of, it's called contributory negligence. And if, in fact, it was shown that the injured person was in any respect at fault, they got nothing, regardless of how much fault was on the other party. And, you know, today, by statute and court decision, that's gone away in every jurisdiction, but that was the rule. And at the trial, the jury found Mrs. Paul contributed to her injuries. And the opinion at that point is not unusual. Justice Frick found that it was an error to instruct the jury that the fact that an injury occurred was evidence of negligence. And that's where the case goes off on a trajectory that no one expects. Mrs. Paul's lawyer, Mr. S.P. Armstrong. Mr. Armstrong was secretary of the two non-Mormon parties in Salt Lake City, the Liberal and American Party. He filed a post-judgment affidavit for a new trial. And the basis of this affidavit is very, very interesting. He swears, Joseph S. Smith was president of the streetcar company. He's president of the church. And one of the doctrines of the church is that the prophet, seer, and revelator is infallible. And he swears that there was a secret priesthood meeting in the tabernacle at which Joseph F. Smith instructed his followers that they were not to vote against corporations. that there were grafters in the county seeking by every possible trick to secure verdicts against corporations by means of damage suits. And therefore, the verdict ought to be overturned. And implicit in Mr. Armstrong's argument is Marmon shouldn't be on juries because they'll just vote as the church tells them to do. And Justice Frick found not a single fact to be accurate. He said, there's no evidence that there was a secret priestly meeting. There's no evidence that any of the people on the jury were at a secret priestly meeting. There's no evidence that any of the people on the jury heard about a secret priestly meeting. And what's more, we're not going to disenfranchise Mormons. And he goes on even further, and he defends the constitutional rights of the church to teach whatever it believes. He says that Mr. Smith has every right to freely communicate with his congregation. And in fact, we're not going to disenfranchise Mormons. And so even with the perception that the church was aligned with corporations, the court wasn't going to bite on that argument. However, I think it should be recognized that the court, even with non-Mormons on it, was very deferential to the church and the church leadership. Just to give you one example of a case called 1910 case, again the same court, called Grant versus Lawrence. And this is Heber J. Grant. Heber J. Grant was opened the church mission in Japan, and Grant, like all the other apostles except Reed Smoot, was a polygamist. And when he went to Japan, he took one of his wives, Augusta, with him to Japan, leaving his other wife, Emily, at home. And when he came home from Japan, he built a large house on South Temple for Augusta. And then he was called to preside over the church in Europe, and he took his wife, Emily. Well, while he was in London, he was sued by Franklin Lawrence. And to start a suit, what you do is you hand a copy of the papers to the defendant, and there's also that which is called substituted service, where you leave a copy of the papers at the place where the person lives. Well, Mr. Lawrence served Augusta. And when Heber J. Grant comes home, he brings a suit to set aside the judgment. And the basis of his suit is, that's not where I usually reside. And even though polygamy is an open secret in Utah at the time, the Supreme Court agrees that you can't serve a person by serving his polygamous wife. Very funny case. And it's not the only case. It's not the only example of the court showing deference. I can't say that I've done a scientific survey. I can't say that I haven't missed any cases, but I found no cases in the time period in which the court ruled against the church or its leaders, including cases, arbitration, ordinary business cases, grants of land. And part of the court's, a good part of the court's business in that era was winding up the probate affairs of polygamous men, and they show a great deal of deference to the institution. Now, the second thing I want to talk about, besides the fact that the courts aligned the church with corporations and weren't really likely to rule against the court, is the jury selection. Now, I was looking at this. Jury selection started in the Joe Hill case on June 10th, 1914. It was concluded the following Monday, June 17th. There was about a day of argument. The case went to the jury at Friday at 5, and they had a verdict by 11. So we see that jury selection really took up more than half of the trial. But to understand what happened, I have to know that. That's, in fact, a picture of Joseph Kimball. That's from Pioneers and Prominent Man, 1913. So that's pretty much what he looked like in 1914. And I would just ask, do you really want this man to be on the jury for an itinerant labor. The first thing I have to tell you about, though, is Joe Hill's lawyers, because I can't tell you how incompetent it was to put Joseph Kimball on the jury without telling you about his lawyers. He was represented by two people. The most prominent one was a man named Ernest D. McDougall. And the newspapers of the day spell his name M.C.D., but he's rather consistent about spelling it M.A.C. And the central character in the Joe Hill trial is almost unknown from the literature. Nobody knows anything about him. They misspell his name. Some of the books don't even mention him. It's difficult to locate McDougall in history. There's really no photograph that I've been able to find. He was born in Ontario, Canada. We find him in the 1900 census, and he's living in Detroit, and he claims to be a lawyer. That's really not an accurate claim, because the Michigan State Supreme Court shows a bar admission date of June 23rd, 1901. He also claims that in 1901, he was a lawyer in Cripple Creek, Colorado. The Colorado Supreme Court has no records indicating that he ever was admitted to practice there. And Cripple Creek in 1901 was the site of a very, very significant labor dispute in the West. And if you look at the secondary literature, you find nothing about McDougall. He's in the 1910 census. He's a school teacher in Kansas. I've looked, but I can't find admission to the Kansas bar. He was admitted to Wyoming bar in August of 1913. He lists his prior profession as strike breaker, which I thought was pretty funny. He also shows that he was living in the county poorhouse. Using Westlaw again, we find that in March 1914, he handled the probate matter successfully. A young woman had been put in the asylum, and he was able to secure a release. And this is the only time that, prior to the case, he appears in the Westlaw database. There's no other record of him doing significant legal work. Joe Hill tells his story about he's in jail. And a lawyer shows up and says, I'm new in town, I'll take your case for free. And Joe Hill says, that meets my pocketbook, and agrees. To confirm how long McDougall had actually been in Salt Lake City, I called Pat Bartholomew, who's the clerk of the Utah Supreme Court. And every time a lawyer is admitted to the court, they have a roll of attorneys. And the attorney signs it, and this goes back to territorial days. And she was actually able to find his bar admission, and his admission date was June 4th, 1914, which is 6 days before the trial started. So, in fact, he was new in town. Subsequent to the completion of the Joe Hill trial, he returned to Wyoming, where he was the socialist candidate for justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court. He had no chance of winning because the Democrats and Republicans had agreed on a candidate, but he went all over Wyoming speaking on socialism. After losing the election, he returned to Utah. He has a very sketchy history in Utah. He spoke before the Liberal Club on March 19, 1915. He complained that the Utah legislature never did anything for working men. In 1915, he returned to Wyoming. He represented the union against his former secretary in a case of embezzlement, and he lost. But in its opinion, the Wyoming court lists his residence as Murray City, Utah. In 1916, he went to the Uinta Basin. Now, my mother's from the Basin, so I spent every summer of my young life on their farm in Duchesne County. He represented the Duchesne Land Company. He was living in Mighton, but he immediately gets nominated for the socialist candidate for district attorney in Duchesne County. And he goes all over the basin talking about socialism. He wears out his welcome. He's living in Mighton, And the only time I've ever heard of this in the history of American trial law, he wears out his welcome, and the people of Mighton give him 24 hours to get out of town. He returns to Kansas in 1920. He was again teaching school. Using Westlaw, we know he moved to Chicago by 1928, and he's handling some rather minor personal injury cases. There's no evidence that either before or after Joe Hill he ever handled a criminal case. 1936, he wrote a book, Speculation and Gambling. He talks all about gambling, but mostly he's complaining about grain speculation. The book sells, and thereafter he disappears completely from the genealogical, legal, and historical record. Now, if a lawyer intends to do a case where he's not competent, he can associate. Well, McDougal did associate, and who did he associate with? A fellow named Frank B. Scott. And again, I don't have a photo, but Scott was rather notorious in Salt Lake City. He was born in Nova Scotia. He went to college in Canada, very affiliated with the socialists. So again, you have two Canadian socialists defending Joe Hill. He was in Salt Lake City by 1905, and he advertises quite heavily, but he advertises that he was a patent lawyer, which is exactly where you would go to find counsel to help you in the biggest murder trial in Utah. Joe Hill calls him a shyster, and Joe Hill was right. Frank Scott had a terrible business reputation. And again, using Westlaw, we find him mired in heavy litigation by cheating people in the Montana mine before coming to Utah. He had a coal mine fraud where he formed a corporation and, in spite of the fact there was no coal mine, he sold the stock. He was involved in further litigation over a corporation to buy a hotel. Scott was a joiner. He was a chairman of the Utah Socialist Party and introduced Eugene Debs when the presidential candidate came to Salt Lake City. He comes up with this idea for a food cooperative, and he promotes the heck out of it. He's always promoting this. He just promotes it tirelessly. He was also big in the Moose Lodge, and he formed the Canadian Club in Salt Lake City. But in spite of these activities, he was financially in poor shape. He's on the tax delinquent rolls from 1908 to 1915, 1926 in the Utah case, where the state took custody of one of his grandchildren. The court noted that F.B. Scott has no money to take care of his child. When the Depression started, he moved to Reno. He formed a law partnership with an imaginary lawyer whose imaginary name started with AA because the phone books were coming out, and he wanted to have the first listing. The Nevada court was not impressed with his phone book listing, but they were even less impressed with the fact that he represented both a husband and a wife in a contested divorce. And so they disbarred him. That's the people that are representing Joe Hill. And so we come to the jury selection. Now I have to explain some legal terms. If any of you have been called to a jury, either the court or the lawyers ask you questions. That's called voir dire. And in some courts, particularly in Salt Lake County, it's all conducted by the judge. Lawyers submit questions ahead of time, the judge asks all the questions. However, in this particular case, voir dire was handled solely by the lawyers. And what happened was, in brief, is McDougal and Scott, and you can see this from the Supreme Court opinion, McDougal and Scott spent their time asking stock questions about the burden of proof, the presumption of innocence, and not finding him guilty, that he doesn't have to prove anything. And we can see from sources that have been cited, and we can also see from the Supreme Court opinion, that they went on for hours and hours, sometimes taking 3 hours, and the judge got mad at them. cut it off. Now, there's only two reasons why, legitimate reasons for asking questions of a jury person. One is to find out if they're legally incompetent to serve because they have preconceived notions, and the other is to intelligently use what are called peremptory challenges, where a lawyer can dismiss a juror for any reason or no reason just because they don't like your looks. And every side in both of these cases has peremptory challenges. Now, instead of intelligently asking people about their background, McDougall and Scott just spent their time trying to propagandize the jury, and again, the judge got mad at it and cut it off. Now, the method they were using to select the jury is different from what you might have experienced had you been called to jury duty today. If you're called to jury duty today, they put in Utah 8 people in the jury box, and then they question them, and they move to strike them if they're not competent to sit because they have formed opinions, and then the lawyers can exercise their peremptory challenges as to anyone in the panel. It's not what they were doing in the Joe Hill trial. What they were doing in the Joe Hill trial was they were calling one person at a time to the box. They would question him, challenge him for cause, and then at that point, exercise peremptory challenges as to that one juror only. And because they were using the system, we can tell the order the jurors were put in the box. And we can tell, you know, whether or not McDougall or Scott had peremptory challenges. And the interesting thing is that according to the news reports, Joseph Kimball, was either the second or third juror put in the box, which means that they had plenty of peremptory challenges in their pocket. It also means that they intended to put Joseph Kimball on the jury. Now, it's pretty clear from the news accounts that Judge Morris Ritchie was having a terrible time getting a jury. And as I said, jury selection starts on June 10th and is completed only on June 17th. And if you read the Tribune, I think the Tribune is pretty sensational reporting, surprisingly. But if you read the Tribune, the reason why they went through so many prospective jurors was that these jurors, who were all men, figured out that the way to get off jury service was to answer that you would find him guilty if he didn't take the stand. And so they were going through all kinds of people. There's a story Joe Hill tells, which is actually true, that in the first day of jury selection, Judge Ritchie had run out of prospective jurors, and 8 people who had been on a previous jury came into his room to report the verdict, and he says, "Get in here, you're sitting for this one too." Now, there are people who think that was wrong. Probably not. The law says any competent citizen can sit on a jury, and there's all kinds of apocryphal stories about when you run out of prospective jurors, sending the sheriff out to rope people in on the street. So that's probably not true. Using their stock questions, McDougall and Scott had no chance of figuring out who Joseph Kimball was. Joe Hill says he was an old man, and in fact he was an old man. He was born in 1851, and by 20 years the oldest person on the jury. The real question that no one answers is, who was Joseph Smith Kimball? And for that I have to take you briefly into Mormon history. Joseph Smith, founder of the church, had a revelation on polygamy as early as 1832, but he didn't practice it until the saints moved to Nauvoo in 1843. At that point, he, of course, was sealed to a great number of women. But the second and third women that he married in polygamy were Priscinda and Zina Huntington. Huntington family, some of the earliest converts. William Huntington is in the Doctrine and Covenants. He's a member of the Nauvoo State High Council. It's interesting today in the Mark Hoffman discussion, they had a list of people that Hoffman admitted that he'd forged, and one was, of course, Zina Huntington Smith Young, and the other was the brother Oliver Huntington. Now, Priscinda and Zina were in their mid-20s when sealed to Joseph. After Joseph died, they were sealed to the other surviving apostles. Zina was sealed to Brigham Young, and Priscinda was sealed to Heber C. Kimball. Priscinda had two children with Heber C. Kimball. Her first child, a little girl, drowned in City Creek when they first got here. But in 1851, Joseph Kimball was born. So at the time of the Joe Hill trial, he had a brother, J. Golden Kimball, as a general authority. His nephew, Orson F. Whitney, was an apostle. His sister was married to church president Joseph F. Smith. And if you really want to get accurate, he had a 20-year-old nephew, future church president Spencer W. Kimball, who was knocking on doors as a missionary in St. Louis. He was well-connected. He was so well-connected that when church president Wilford Woodruff died, he was on the committee that arranged the funeral. And after the Joe Hill case, he and his wife were the first official guides on Temple Square. His personal life's interesting. He's a young man. He was called by Brigham Young to settle Rich County. He became quite wealthy in the ranching business. He invested in mines and irrigation companies from Idaho to Mexico. 28 years as bishop in Rich County, moved to Logan, founded the Logan Chamber of Commerce, and was bishop there for 8 years. McDougall and Scott didn't figure out his political connections. 2 years in the territorial legislature, served on the Constitutional Convention, and also served in the legislature after statehood. Now, it's just really hard for me to figure out why McDougall and Scott thought this man had anything in common with Joe Hill. It's just using their stock questions, they just didn't figure out who he was. Now, there are a lot of schools of thought about how you do how you use your peremptory challenges. In Alaska, there's a criminal trial lawyer, very successful one, Edgar Paul Boyko, who gave a seminar on how to pick a jury by using horoscopes. And if you read the trial literature, it'll tell you all kinds of things. Don't put Presbyterians on the jury. Don't put Methodists on the jury. And I don't see how that advice makes any sense. In our law firm, we have a courtroom, and it's not just an advertising device. We do a lot of mock trials. And we find anomalies in juries. But the only thing I can think of that you can use your preemptory challenges is to get rid of the outliers. And that's people that you just can't, that are on one side or the other. And I really can't think of any valid reason why McDougall and Scott would not have gotten rid of Joseph Kimball. I wouldn't want someone on the jury, particularly when McDougall argued that the legal system in Utah was fundamentally flawed. I wouldn't want someone from the Constitutional Convention or someone who'd been in the legislature hearing that argument. And this is not religious bias. The lawyers have to bring the jury along with them, and you don't want someone whose personal authority is greater than your own on the jury. The fact remains that the copper bosses didn't sneak him onto the jury, the Mormon church didn't sneak him onto the jury, no one snuck him onto the jury, Judge Ritchie didn't sneak him onto the jury, but McDougall and Scott wanted him on the jury. And I've had cases, trial cases, where the case was lost or won in jury selection. That may or may not have been the case here, but they started the case with a really heavy burden with him on the jury. Now, the final thing I want to talk about is a very famous lawyer in the Progressive era. Judge Oren, after Hill was convicted, the union came in and they had money and they had a defense committee and they hired a very important lawyer named Warren Hilton. And if you look at the time period and you look at the body of work, Judge Hilton is much more important in the labor movement than even Clarence Darrow. He has this tremendous body of work. He's almost forgotten today, which is in some ways too bad. He was born in Massachusetts, educated in Bates College, very loyal to Bates College. Went to Michigan, served two terms as circuit court judge, which is why he's known as Judge Hilton. He moved to Colorado around 1890. He was general counsel for the Western Federation of Miners, and he did some rather spectacular trials. He got Vincent St. John, the IWW and Western Federation of Miners organizer, off of some rather serious murder trials. He did the spectacular trial of Steve Adams in Colorado that ended the Telluride labor wars. He's involved in trials throughout the West. And if you read the Salt Lake Press, everybody knows who you're talking about when you say Judge Hilton. And Hilton alone among the lawyers, labor lawyers, he worked for money. It wasn't ideology with him. He was an Episcopalian and a Colorado Republican. He'd wait for years to get paid, but he always did get paid. On the other hand, he was very protective of his clients. He followed Vincent St. John around the country protecting him. Now, just to give you just a flavor of how good of lawyer, that's Judge Hilton there. That's from a Colorado Bar magazine taken in 1912. And so that's perhaps pretty close to what he looked like at the time of the Canadian thing. The thing I need to tell you about is the most creative thing he ever did, and that is he got involved in the Idaho murder case of when the Idaho governor Frank Stunenberg was blown up by a bomb on his front gate. Rather easily, the authorities picked up a suspect named Harry Orchard, which was the name he was going by at the time. And Orchard quickly confesses that he blew up Governor Stunenberg. He also confesses to the murder of a large number of other men, some of whom were undoubtedly alive. But he says he did it at the behest of the leadership of the Western Federation of Miners. And so with some machinations, they pick up three leaders of the union in Colorado, take them to Boise for trial. They put up Bill Haywood for trial first. He's the secretary of the union because they thought they had the strongest case. And this trial of Haywood is very famous. Clarence Darrow did it, there's books about that trial. What happened in that trial, however, was that Darrow put Haywood on the stand, and the most important lawyer at the time was William Borah, who cross-examined Haywood very, very effectively, and also Borah, who had just been elected senator, did the rebuttal. And, of course, Haywood was acquitted. Clarence Darrow started the trial of Pettibone, the second person they put up, but he got a massive ear infection, and they sent for Judge Hilton to finish it. And what happened was Judge Hilton, at that point, did something that was very extraordinary. He agreed that Borah was the most effective person in the courtroom, and he didn't want to put Pettibone on the stand for cross-examination. So he comes to court, and the judge says, "Mr. Hilton, what's your defense?" "We aren't putting one on." "Time to argue," the regular prosecutor argues. "Mr. Hilton, are you going to argue?" "We aren't going to argue." And what he did by that is he kept Senator Boris from cross-examining, and he kept him sitting on the sideline with his rebuttal ready to go. And Hilton was right. Nobody would convict on the strength of Harry Orchard. Hilton was familiar with Salt Lake. In 1905, the American Party of Non-Mormons took over the city government and put in a new police force. Unfortunately, that police force was corrupt, and they were running a crooked poker game and getting people as they were coming through, and they had a guy who was running the game, a Mr. Parent. One of the people who got cheated went to the district attorney, and charges were brought against Police Chief Sheets. Crook, that is caught in bed with the police, probably doesn't have much chance, so Mr. Parent got scared and went to Colorado and hired Judge Hilton. And Hilton figured the only way he could get him off was pleading him guilty, and he actually becomes a special prosecutor. The police chief actually gets off by through the use of a lawyer named Soren Christensen, who would also play in the Joe Hill case. Now, one thing you have to know, just a couple things, and I mean, Hilton believed in phrenology. He thought he could tell a criminal by the shape of his head, and he thought he could tell a non-criminal by the shape of his head. That's how he viewed crime. Now, just briefly, Judge Hilton was a Freemason, which isn't all that unusual at the turn of the 20th century, because that was the high point of ritualistic lodges in the United States. However, as people are well aware, Masonry had a strong history in Utah, where Mormons were Masons and Masons were Mormons. For doctrinal reasons, Masons thought Mormons were stealing their secrets in the temple ceremony, of course, Mormons reciprocated. The view of Masons at the time were that Mormons were untrustworthy with Masonic secrets. Mormons were not innocent in that. In that decade, an individual Mormon named Matthew Thompson, was running a Masonic diploma mill out of Salt Lake City. And with the emphasis that Masons put on regularity, this couldn't have been anything other than infuriating to Judge Hilton. His attitudes about Mormons from Masonry came to no good in the Joe Hill matter. Now, Judge Hilton had some really bad habits. He was a press hound. Every case he had in the West, he'd call in the press and give press conferences. The other thing that he did was he'd pick out one person in each trial and really make fun of them. And he'd vilify people. He had enemies across the West. And in the Joe Hill case, he picked out, he's particularly antagonistic to Chief Justice Straub. He repeatedly attacked him for fairness, and he insulted his intellect. But before Joe Hill was executed, Hilton had made enemies of virtually the entire Utah community. Now, he's a press hound. But he also knew the value of propaganda. And by the time Joe Hill was executed and thereafter, Judge Hilton had wittingly or unwittingly become a propaganda tool for the IWW. One thing we can say is that using the legal search Westlaw, this was his first appeal and only appeal. Now, there's a difference in appellate law between appellate law and trial law. Appellate law is more cerebral. The thing that you're concerned with is not, you know, a jury appeal to get people riled up, but whether the law was properly applied in the lower court. and Judge Hilton struggled mightily with those standards. The Utah Press was very unkind to him. They quoted his arguments as being outrageous and unheard of. They were very unkind to him in that. His argument, you have to read the opinion to get some of the things, but he tells about the main argument that he made was that this case was the same as a case called State versus Jay Hill. And I was worried that that was Joseph Hill, but it wasn't. In this case, this Joe Hill was a laboring man, and the sheriff of Midville and four people they called Austrians were drinking in a saloon. Austrians didn't speak English. Two robbers come in and start blasting. One of the Austrians has a gun and shoots one of them, and before he dies, he refuses to tell the name of the other of his confederate. When the case comes to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court gets a translation of what the Austrians actually said, and they said, the witnesses said this guy was 6 foot, he's only 5'10", 5'9". They said he was brown-eyed, this guy's blue-eyed, he said he has skinny nose, this guy doesn't. We don't think this is the right guy. And they reversed for a new trial. Now, Hilton argued that this case was analogous to his. Justice Stroud didn't think so. The distinction was that Joe Hill had been wounded and that there were witnesses that placed him in a man of his description in the vicinity of the crime. He then argued the credibility of the witnesses. Anybody who's ever done appellate law knows you don't do that. It's one of the worst mistakes that you can do. I just got one quote I'll briefly tell you. This is Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit, speaking at BYU Law Review. He says, when a lawyer resorts to a jury argument on appeal, you can see the judges all sit back and give a big sigh of relief. We understand you have to say all these things to keep your client happy, but we also understand that you know, and that we know, and you know that we know, your case doesn't amount to a hill of beans. The credibility argument has greatly impressed people over the years, but the court acted in absolutely predictable manner. There's nothing wrong with the Joseph Hillstrom opinion, and in the light of history, there's nothing unusual about the court's refusal. The circumstantial evidence part of the case was quoted in its entirety in a 1950 decision, and the Hillstrom case has been cited with approval as late as 1988. Now, Judge Hilton and his followers couldn't believe that he lost such a case, and from then on he acted very badly. With the assistance of Hilton, Hill filed a petition in the Commutation Board. Now, there's one thing that's absolutely for certain. In the Commutation Board, which was consisted of the Attorney General, the three justices, and now the Governor, William Spry, Joe Hill no longer had a Fifth Amendment privilege to avoid self-incrimination. And if Hilton and Hill had wanted to get him off, they had to give new facts. But Hilton refused, and you can see it all through the press over and over again. He refuses to give new facts. He says, I'm just going to argue on the record. It gets so bad that Governor Spry, who is not the brightest bulb in the room, says, Hilton, can't you make this man talk? And the justices really don't want to shoot this guy, but they need something to help them get along with their Mormon constituency. They can't look soft on crime, so they need something to help. And you can read the press as it goes on. The press is really unkind to Judge Hilton, making this argument. It's over and over again. Hilton's not willing to stop. This result is only an example of the iniquitous system, the most unjust, wicked travesty of justice that has occurred in the West. Said it could easily demonstrate Joe Hill's innocence to an impartial board. the justices just weren't buying this argument. They kept saying, give us some more evidence. And what ultimately happened is two of the justices said to Hilton and Hill, take the sheriff, go out, talk to your witnesses, and if you're innocent, we'll let you go. And the only people that will ever know about this are the members of the board and the warden. We'll never tell. And Hilton says, no, you have the burden of proof. He doesn't have to say anything, and we aren't going to say anything. I really don't think they wanted to shoot him, but Hilton would give them absolutely nothing to work with. There was a lack of political will by the board to resolve the matter. If they just put him in jail, we wouldn't care. We'd never be talking about this. But they didn't. He started a publicity campaign. He was in all the newspapers. He challenged the justices to a public debate. He put up big posters in Salt Lake City. Said the pending execution was worse than the Mountain Meadows Massacre. He offered to start a law school in Salt Lake and admit Chief Justice Straub to the kindergarten class. Sure. And again, once again, the press is not very kind. And the Utah press just really goes after Hilton. Hilton was playing to a national audience. And when he's playing to the national audience, he was really... he was really not considering how it was going over. Well, anyway, Joe Hill was executed on the 19th of November, 1915. He told Hilton he didn't want to be buried in Utah. The IWW took his wife to Chicago. They had a large funeral. Reportedly, 20,000 people attended. And the main orator was Judge Hilton. And he was very impressed with his speech. He had it taken down and published it and distributed it throughout the country. Here's the tenor. The genesis of this transaction and the tragedy of Salt Lake City took rise in the bureaucratic power of the Mormon Church, bureaucracy denominated by greed, selfishness, and a plenitude of power that has defied the government of the United States and today teaches its followers that supreme power rests in the Church, that it will visit with vengeance upon any questioning of its power. Don't let anybody, my friends, fool you in the belief that this lying story, that this power is diminishing. It was never so powerful as it is today, never so dangerous. He talked about Mountain Meadows. He called the church the vilest thing in our national life today, the hideous, slimy monster which has made this crime, Hill's execution, here possible. He claimed that a Mormon jury convicted him and a Mormon governor refused commutation. Do you believe, men and women of Chicago, that this silent form would be in your midst today if Joe Hillstrom had been a good Mormon, paying his tithe promptly to the church, had two, three, or four women, wives, to call him husband? I do not say this was done by direct influence other than the imponderable and undefined but always present and always dominating fear of the Mormon church. The Utah press went crazy, they actually went crazy on this. Now, the Mormons understood exactly what was going on. It was not the copper bosses that shot Joe Hill, but the Mormon church, and it was reigniting the Reed Smoot matter. It was reigniting the polygamy matter. Well, while that was a declaration of war against the church, it was also a declaration of war against the non-Mormon court, because the court well understood that Judge Hilton was attacking their impartiality. He's basically saying that they took orders from Joseph F. Smith in the Hilton matter. And you can follow the proceedings that came thereafter. Within a month, It's throughout all the Salt Lake papers. I quoted particularly the Telegram. Within a month, they had brought charges against Hilton. Hilton said to the national press, I don't doubt that with the power of the Mormon church that I can take away my license. He filed a brief where he said he was sorry, but then he called a press conference and said he wouldn't take back anything he had said. Now, the night before the hearing, he was in Salt Lake City, but he decided he had other pressing business. Justice Straub was just waiting to unload on him, and Soren Christensen came in. They asked Christensen whether there was any evidence of the Mormon Church involvement. Christensen said, "I never heard of such thing. Hilton had no right to make such statements," and as he did without acquainting himself with the facts. Anyway, they were really mad at him. The only thing Justice Straub, write an opinion. He uses literary language that only Hilton could understand. He told the world exactly how little he thought of Judge Hilton. Well, the year after he was disbarred, his alma mater, Bates College, awarded him an honorary degree for his long service to the profession. And in 1924, when Justice Straub was off the court, Judge Hilton requested reinstatement. He was very sorry, and they reinstated him. And that is perhaps how Mormons were involved in Joe Hill. And I thank you very much.
Let me just quote a little bit from a song that Ken played. "I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died," said he. "I never died," said he. And here we are nearly 100 years later, talking about the fact that the facts of this case and Joe Hill. You know, I first encountered Joe Hill in the late 1960s as a student at the University of Utah. I believe I've thought about him and that case almost every day since. And I'm not sure I know him or understand that case any better today than when I first encountered it more than 40 years ago. I don't know whether he was guilty or innocent. And anybody that tells you they do know, now I'm speaking as a layman, not a lawyer, but anybody who tells you they do know, I don't think does know. I think Joe Hill took that question with him to the grave. You know, I'm not sure that there's a hereafter, but if there is, there's two or three Joes I would like to have, if you will, a cup of Joe with. Okay? Joe Smith would be on that list. I'd like to talk to him. Joe Stalin would be on that list. I'd like to talk to him. Joe Hill would definitely be on that list. Who was this guy? Who was this immigrant? This unlettered, unskilled, everyday worker? Part of that millions and millions of immigrants from the old country to the new country who ended up where we are 100 years later nearly still talking about him. You know, I might also like to talk to Shoeless Joe Jackson. I'd like to find out a little bit about that Black Sox stuff. I'm sure about some things. Kenneth said there's a lot of unknowns, and there are some unknowns. But there are some knowns. I'm sure about some things. I know that Hill was shot on that cold January night in Salt Lake. Now, he wasn't the only one shot that night. Several people in Salt Lake County had bullet wounds that night. Joe was among them. I know that the Morrisons were killed that night in their store. I know that Hill was executed for the crime in November of 1915. Think about how quickly that moved through the legal system from that first encounter in January to the execution. Despite the delays and things, it was less than 2 years, something we don't usually associate these days. I got to know some of the people who knew, who were part of the case, or were related to people who were. When I was a very, very young man, and he was a very, very old man, I interviewed Merlin Morrison, the boy that was in that store when his father and his brother were killed. He could remember that day 70 years later vividly. He closed his eyes, and he called that up and told me what he remembered. I knew Soren Christensen's brother Ray, who told me that Joe Hill had the most piercing, cold eyes he had ever seen in his life. On the other hand, I talked to people who said, I knew him because of the songs he wrote. How could someone write the kinds of songs that he wrote and be a killer? The Morrison family suffered greatly that night in January. And in many ways, Merlin and his family never got over losing those two. And as far as I can tell, they were good, honest, hardworking people. A storekeeper and his 17-year-old son. But John Morrison had been a cop. And he had put some people in jail. One of which was a guy named Frank Z. Wilson. Now that was the one name he used, but not the only name he used. He had a list of aliases a mile long, as they say. And he just got out of the pen. And he said, I'm going to settle the score with John Morrison. When Joe Hill was arrested that first night, they said to him, what's your name? He said, I'm Joseph Hillstrom. And the press said the next day, he tells us he's Joseph Hillstrom. But we know he's Frank Z. Wilson. When they find out he's an IWW, they stop looking for Frank Wilson. We'll talk more about Frank Wilson in a minute. Why do they do that? Because they get a communique from the chief of police in San Pedro, California, who says, you have found your man. He doesn't say, you found who killed the Morrisons. He says, in effect, you have found someone. You can convict for this crime, and you can do a service by exposing the evilness of the IWW. Joe Hill clearly wanted to be a martyr. Some ways the state allowed him that role. Kenneth Lugia brings his legal and historical skills to bear on a very complicated case. And he looks at some very key questions in terms of the influence of Mormons, both individually and collectively in this case, on the Supreme Court, not on the Supreme Court, but on the jury selection. He talks about the Supreme Court. I think he shows demonstrably what Joe Hill did know, that he had a shyster and an incompetent for his two lawyers, and he ultimately ends up firing him. Sounds a little bit like Warren Jeffs. They did him no service. And Joe said, I don't have to prove I'm innocent. You have to prove I'm guilty. Now, he may have been sophomoric in his belief about that protection and not understanding the legal situation, but he honestly, that's what he believed, or that's what he said he believed. And on the day he died, he said, I've never harmed a single soul in my life. Okay. Then why in the world won't you tell the story of what happened to you? Well, he said, I don't have to prove I'm innocent. It didn't ring true with a lot of people. I think Kenneth is also correct in the sense that he raises some real important issues about that case. It's clearly the story, as he says, is the key. The connections to all of the things that are going around. And Joe Hill has taken upon himself a persona larger than this immigrant worker that was executed in Salt Lake County. When I heard the funeral of Hubert H. Humphrey in 1977, which went on longer than even a Mormon funeral, and they go on for a long time. And somewhere along the way, they sang, I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night. I thought, this boy has come mainstream here today. Kent is right about his quotability. What he said was, could you arrange to have my body hauled over to the Wyoming line? It's only 75 miles. I don't want to be found dead in Utah. Well, some of us every once in a while have that. You know, we say, you know, he said, don't mourn, organize. And you see that everywhere. Where did that come from, this ability? He coined, as you say, the phrase pie in the sky. He entered things into our lexicon. Who was this guy? He took popular tunes and changed the words because they were simple to sing and to make a point. Where the Fraser River flows, every fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows, and we're going to make them pay boys. We're going to win for shorter hours and better pay boys, and we're going to make them pay where the Fraser River flows. That's a very simple song, and it conveys a very simple message. He used those kinds of terms, hymns, popular songs of the day, to make that point. At some point along the way, whether he was guilty or innocent, I don't know. He said, I didn't kill that man. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But somewhere along the way, he decided that he was more useful as a martyr than as just somebody who would be freed. He had plenty of opportunities to say who that woman was. I did my master's thesis on an attorney named Parley P. Christensen. Spry said to him, Parley, go out to the penitentiary, have him tell you who the woman was, you come tell me, and I'll commute his sentence. Joe Hill said, I don't want a commutation. I don't want to be commuted from something that I didn't do. Now, was that a strategy? I don't know. There are a couple of important things in closing let me just mention. First thing, I don't think you can understand this case unless you understand the context, and Kenneth alludes to this, of what it was like in Utah in the period between 1890 and 1930. It is the most interesting, important, significant period in Utah's history. Easy for me to say, that's the period of time I study, right? How about that? Utah was a colony. It was a third world colony of the federal government and of Eastern capitalist interests, in much the same way as the United States under mercantilism was a colony of Britain. We supplied raw goods to Eastern capitalists, they turned them into finished products, and we bought them. The IWW understood the nature of multinational corporate capitalism long before many people did. Now, you can argue whether or not their solution to that question is right or not. That's another issue. But they understood that corporate capitalism was a worldwide thing that was not constrained by borders. And the IWW argued there are only two kinds of people in the world, those who work and those who don't work. And among the people who don't work, there are two classes. There are people you and I would call bums who won't work, and there are rich people who don't work because they live off the labor of those other people who do. Now, again, you can disagree or agree with that analysis, but they had a way of simplifying a very complex situation. This is not a simple case. Was the LDS Church anti-IWW? Without a doubt. Were they anti-radical? Absolutely. Did they think Wobblies and socialists and everybody else were all bad and all the same? Yes, they did. Did the non-Mormon power structure in Salt Lake City hold the same views? Of course they did. What united them was more important than what divided them. They may have been divided over religion, but they were united in terms of their opposition to fundamental challenges to the power structure. One other, and the Socialist Party is important in Utah in this period of time. Over 125 individuals are elected to office in the state of Utah, saying, if you elect me, I will overthrow the capitalist system. And they don't do it, they can't, but they say they will. And who were these people? Some were non-Mormons. But my colleague John McCormick and I have studied this, and when we found people named Wilford Woodruff Freckleton and Parley Pratt Washburn and Joseph Smith Jessup, there were some strong Mormons who were hearkening back to the communitarianism of their Mormon past in this period of corporate capitalism. Last thought. Who are the key players here? Well, clearly, Joe Hill's a key player. The people that Kenneth has talked about in terms of the court, legal system, the attorneys, those incompetent, even the socialists wouldn't have Scott McDougall. They kept saying, don't blame us for them. We don't want them either. But there are a couple of other key players. There's a guy named Otto Appelquist. Otto and Joe were fellow workers together. They'd known each other for a while. They lived in a small cabin in Murray, Utah. One night, Otto and a woman named Hilda Erickson and another person went to the Empress Theater downtown. They found a note in Joe's pocket that said, Otto and I were here. We went to the Empress. Where were you, Hilda? The night Joe Hill was wounded, he came back home to the cabin he was staying in. A group of Swedish immigrant folks called the Azaleas family living out in South Salt Lake. Otto and Joe had a conversation, and Otto Appelquist left, never to be seen or heard from again. Hilda Erickson went to that trial every day. 50 years later, she told a researcher, here's what happened. I was sweet on Otto, and then I got to be sweet on Joe. Otto shot Joe. That's what it was all about. For the love of God, why didn't you stand up and say that in 1950? Don't tell me that in 1951. But she said that's what happened. Another theory says this. Joe Hill is this big, hotshot radical, and he's involved with a young Mormon girl from his hometown in Gebra, where the Mormons converted lots of Swedes. What was a hard-time radical like Joe Hill doing with a young, sweet Mormon girl? Conversely, what was a young, sweet Mormon girl doing with this big-time radical? Frank Wilson. He's the key to the case. A new book coming out by a man named Bill Adler called The Man Who Never Died raises some of these questions and looks at some of the same things. And when it comes out, it should be out in a month or so, take a look at it. Because when you compare the pictures of Frank Wilson with the pictures of Joe Hill, they look very much alike. And when Merlin's in the court, he says, is this the man that shot your father? Merlin says, he very much resembles the man that shot my father. Frank Wilson had a long, long, long criminal record that continued on after the case. He had a reason. Remember what happened when those two folks were killed? It wasn't a robbery. Two people came into that store and said, "We've got you now." Fired the shots. That's what Merlin testified. No attempt to take money. Why did the police force not pursue Wilson, who seems a logical suspect, once they found Hill? Was it a conspiracy? No. The sheriff that arrested Joe Hill was a socialist. He was a socialist candidate for mayor for sheriff in Murray. The doctor that treated Joe Hill was a socialist. I interviewed his widow. Why did Joe come to the doctor? Because he was a socialist and he knew he wouldn't charge him. Well, once again, 40 years later, he says, Joe confessed to me. I didn't mean to shoot the guy. We just wanted a little bit of money. He got killed. I'm not such a bad guy. Yada, yada, yada. Where were you when we needed you, pal, at the time? He did apply for the reward money, however. And he kept working and working and working trying to get that $500 Dr. McHugh did. He didn't get it. So Joe Hill is the man who never died. Let me leave you with one last thing, and I know we've gone over time, but I apologize. I want you to just think about this and think about it in the context of who this guy Joe Hill was. This is his last will. My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss and moan. Moss does not cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce and let the merry breezes blow my dust to where some fading flower grows. Perhaps some fading flower then would come to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill. Thank you.